But back to the exclusion crisis. In November of 1680, the House of Lords defeated a second exclusion bill, second effort to keep James off the throne. And in March of 1681, Charles dissolved Parliament. What's interesting is that the Whigs went home quietly. They weren't willing to risk another civil war, and indeed, Charles II would never summon another Parliament for the rest of his reign. Instead, on the contrary, in fact, between 1681 and 1684, he would hunt out Whigs in local government and purge them from their positions of power. Indeed, so strong was the position of the monarchy that when Charles II died in 1685, I should note, parenthetically, that he converted to Catholicism on his deathbed, which probably confirmed a lot of suspicions about him. But when he died in 1685, his brother James II mounted the throne more or less without protest. Nevertheless, although James II began his reign in a very strong position, within 3 years he was again off the throne. And I think in the time that remains, I'd like to review how this actually happened. Now, James II, it has to be said, was really a failure as a monarch. He was probably one of the least successful monarchs in all of English history. But nevertheless, for all of James's flaws, and there were many of them, he really wasn't what a lot of his enemies said that he was. He was not trying to eradicate Protestantism by force in England. He was also not trying to establish Catholicism as the sole religion of the country. James certainly did not intend to govern either unconstitutionally, nor did he intend to govern without Parliament. What James's major political aim was to establish the rights of English Catholics to worship without persecution and to take full part in the political life of the country. Now, it goes without saying that James certainly hoped that the undeniable truth of the Catholic religion, at least as he saw it, would in the long run bring the English over to religious truth, but he certainly had no intention of forcing them there. But nevertheless, when all qualifications had been made, when we put together all the nice things we can say about James II, we have to admit that his policies were really stupid. They were stupid for a number of reasons, and above all because they completely failed to take into account how bitter and how deep and how strong the opposition against them really was. It was just politically impossible to try to do what James was going to try to do. Because even though he didn't want to become an absolutist monarch, in the end, that's what too many people thought he was trying to do, and that's what mattered in the end, perception rather than reality. How did James fuel this perception? Well, in 1685, late in the year 1685, James II announced his intention to repeal the Test and Corporation Acts, which had kept, you'll recall, non-Anglicans out of office. In Ireland, James then began purging the royal army of Protestants and replacing them with Catholics. James then extended the purges to local government, especially among the lieutenancies and commissions of the peace. In 1687, James then opened a campaign to build support among the Protestant dissenters by proclaiming a Declaration of Indulgence. Ironically, he went about this by trying to work through the parliamentary system. He began building up a powerful electoral organization as part of the campaign to pack Parliament, not exactly what you would think in an absolutist monarch. Nevertheless, James's efforts provoked a predictable Anglican response, and six prominent Anglican bishops now signed a petition against the Declaration of Indulgence. Things got an awful lot worse on the 10th of June, 1688, when James's wife, Queen Mary, gave birth to a son. And they got worse now because there was now the possibility of an extended Catholic rule. And this gave Protestants even more reason to unite against the monarchy and to try and do something about James. The situation seems to me in 1688 in England is rather strikingly similar to the situation in France after 1584. That is to say, people are suddenly faced with the prospect of having a monarch and long-term rule by a monarch whose religion is different from that of the majority in the country. On the 30th of June, 1688, therefore, seven leading Protestant parliamentarians wrote a letter to William of Orange, who was James II's son-in-law, pledging their support if he brought a force to England against James. Now, on the 5th of November, 1688, William of Orange came from the Netherlands and landed in southwestern England. Even at this stage, it should be stressed, the final outcome of the conflict was far from certain, because most of the political nation, most Englishmen with property, were really too afraid of a civil war. They'd been through one too recently, and they were too constrained by considerations of non-resistance, by considerations of obedience to a legitimate sovereign, to become open rebels. Indeed, what's interesting about William's coming to England is that the invitation that he received from Parliament was really vague. It didn't say much more about his mission other than they expected him to restrain James. It didn't say they expected him to kick him off the throne. They certainly didn't say they expected him to become king. The object, it seems to most historians, was to force James to make some concessions or some policy changes. But